Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, July 1st. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Shartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, investing in the health care of the Saratoga community, announcing its second robot-assisted surgery system, Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Joining us for Medical Monday today, Dr. Leslie Parikh of the Cardiology Associates of Schenectady at Ellis Medicine. She is here to discuss, predictably, heart health. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, 800-348-2551. We'll get to the heart of the matter with Dr. Leslie Parikh on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Leslie Parikh of the Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine joins us today. Dr. Parikh earned her medical degree from SUNY's Upstate Medical University. She went on to Brown University to complete her internship, residency, and fellowship. Her professional interests include all areas of non-invasive cardiology, particularly valvular heart disease, vascular imaging, and nuclear cardiology. Dr. Parikh was part of the team that performed Ellis' first Watchman procedure last year. The Watchman is a device that's implanted in the heart to reduce the risk of stroke in certain patients. If you have a question, now's the time to call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. You can tweet us if you want at WAMCVoxPop, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Parikh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you here. Now, this Watchman business, what's that?
Yeah, so you know, the Watchman is a new procedure that came out that really offers patients with atrial fibrillation a chance for stroke prevention when they may not be candidates for typical anticoagulation. So what it is it's a device that sits in the part of your heart where blood clots can form. When you have the heart rhythm atrial fibrillation, and it prevents the blood clots from leaving the heart and going to the brain, which could cause a stroke.
What's the part of the heart we're talking about here?
So, you know, it's a specific part of the heart called the left atrial appendage. It's on the top part of the heart, and you could think of it almost as like a little divot. And because it is a divot, it allows blood to pool and a blood clot can form.
That seems like a design flaw. Why would it be there?
You know, it is. It's kind of like the appendix, if you will, of the heart. But yeah, there's no known reason for the appendage aside from, you know, causing some trouble and having blood pool and possible clot formation.
Okay. And how many of these Watchman devices have we implanted so far?
You know, we started about a year ago at Ellis. They've all been very successful without complications. And we've reached about 25 people. Hmm. And, you know, we're still increasing that number a couple times a month. We do about 4 to 5 patients.
Have you made any tweaks to the system, the Watchman system, since it began in the last year?
You know, not really. I'm heavily involved in the imaging part of it. We have some fantastic structural cardiologists that do the actual implantation, and they've been very successful in terms of the approach, and we've had all really good outcomes, and patients have been happy because they've been able to come off of blood thinners.
This is not, then, an active device like a pacemaker. This is a screen sort of a thing?
Exactly. It's kind of almost like a mesh parachute that sits in the little divot of the heart, and it prevents the blood clots from, one, forming, and then if they do form, from leaving the heart. So it just sits there and kind of covers a hole, if you will.
All right. I assume then it would require some maintenance. In other words, do you have to clean out the blood clots after a while?
You don't. You know, what we do is I'm involved and I take some more pictures of your heart through an endoscopy like procedure at about 45 days. And then usually, you know, it looks good and we keep people off of the blood thinner and that's it. You know, we do repeat the image at 1 year just to make sure there's been no changes, but we've been successful so far.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok. We're joined today by Dr. Leslie Parikh of the Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. And let's go to the phones. And Jim and Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Hi, Jim.
What effect does repeated anesthesia have on the heart and general anesthesia?
What effect does repeated anesthesia have on the heart?
You know, Jim, that's a great question. And usually repeated anesthesia should not have any long-term effects on the heart. It gets out of your system within, you know, generally the first 4 to 6 hours, but definitely within the first 24 hours. So assuming the procedures are not extremely prolonged, you shouldn't really be looking at any long-term negative consequences.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jim. The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. In your CV, it said among your interests, non-invasive cardiology. Give me an example.
So, you know, an example of that, really my true passion is with imaging, so echocardiography. So I did a whole advanced year of training in terms of looking at the different ultrasound waves of the heart and doing the procedures where you take a camera and look inside the heart to look for how the heart looks and be able to be involved in the procedures such as the Watchman or the transcatheter aortic valve, also known as the TAVR valve.
And what is that?
So what it is, it's, you know, that's a great procedure that's really hitting its stride now. And it's essentially it's a valve replacement without requiring open heart surgery. You know, it initially began as a procedure for patients that were deemed not appropriate surgical candidates or someone that wouldn't survive surgery.
The older patients?
Exactly. Mm. Older patients, people that have had surgeries before that were very sick with other comorbidities. But, you know, as time has been advancing, we're really learning that it's of benefit to people that, you know, for various reasons don't want to or can't undergo surgery but are not deemed inappropriate.
The technology seems to advance in all other, and I know nothing of the medical profession, but it seems everywhere you turn, technology increases and moves along at almost exponential rates. Mm-hmm. Tell me about bypass. I'm not sure that you're really involved in that, but I was talking to somebody outside of work last week and said, oh, my wife just had bypass. Mm-hmm. And he described it, and it seems like it's a little different than the old days.
Yeah. So, you know, from a cardiology perspective, I am not a surgeon by any
right.
means, but certainly, you know, there are fantastic surgeons out there. And what they do is they do usually put you on bypass, so they stop your heart, and they're able to sew in different grafts onto the heart. And honestly, you know, from a layman's perspective, people are usually in the hospital for about 5 days and going home and feeling good and kind of back to energy and good to go. So,
that's so amazing.
Yeah, between that and now what they can do with stents and different, you know, what we call non-invasive or just interventional procedures, it's very impressive.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday. We're joined today by Dr. Leslie Parikh of the Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. And Dr. Parikh earned her medical degree from SUNY's Upstate Medical University and went on to Brown University. Our number once again is 800-348-2551. And let's jump over here on the phone and we go to Rachel in Fishkill. Rachel.
Hey, Rachel.
Hi. I have a question about genetics. My mother had a lot of strokes. Would I assume that they were caused from blood clots to the brain? You know, they were brain strokes. But are there other reasons for strokes?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Rachel. And yes, there are a lot of different reasons for strokes. Some of the main reasons are not from traveling blood clots per se, but are from cardiac risk factors such as uncontrolled high blood pressure or hypertension or high cholesterol, smoking, or uncontrolled diabetes. That's where the majority of strokes come from. Blood clot strokes, so strokes that occur from a blood clot that comes from the heart to the brain account for about 6 to 10% of strokes. So there's a lot of different reasons. And oftentimes they are not genetic in nature, meaning because your mom had strokes does not put you at increased risk for strokes. You know, the best thing you can do for prevention is really good lifestyle modification. So exercise, eating healthy, and controlling all your risk factors.
Okay, so does that mean that you wouldn't have this procedure done unless you actually had an incident?
Yeah,
it would,
you know,
not be a preventive thing.
Yeah. Yes. So what you would do is this procedure, the Watchman procedure, is performed with people that have atrial fibrillation. So that heart rhythm problem. So if you do not have atrial fibrillation or the rhythm problem, you actually do not need this device.
Awesome. Thank you.
Oh, you're
welcome. Thank you very much.
What causes atrial fibrillation?
You know, the exact mechanism is not known. It's becoming more and more common.
Really? Why?
You know, some of it's thinking as people kind of get, people are living longer, they're getting older, more people are hypertensive, more people are obese. That certainly puts a lot of increased risk for it. We know sleep apnea is a leading cause of it. And it puts more stress or pressure on the heart, which can cause these rhythm problems.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok. Dr. Leslie Parikh is here. We talk cardiology, and we'll be back with more of your calls in a moment. Vox Pop, Medical Monday on WAMC. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Parikh is our guest from Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine. Having fun so far?
Yes, yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me.
You know, my pleasure. And, of course, now from here on in, it's just call after call after call.
Yeah, smooth sailing.
Yep, just hunker down. Here we go. And we go back to the phones. Patrick in Williamstown. Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. I had a question about aortic aneurysms and hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, my father passed away in mid-60s from an aortic aneurysm. And, you know, I try to take care of myself, cholesterol and all that sort of stuff, keeping an eye on that. But what would you say the primary cause of an aortic aneurysm is, and what are the best practices to minimize the risk of that, given that I have a family history of it? Thank you.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of things, some of which if your run-of-the-mill aortic aneurysms, the most common cause is related to long-standing high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Sometimes there are familial reasons for having aortic aneurysms where you have problems with the collagen in your blood vessels. I think generally, you know, depending upon where your father's aneurysm is, a helpful piece of advice would be to get, you know, talk to your physician and probably get an ultrasound just to make sure that your aorta looks okay without any evidence of any dilatation.
Would you recommend any other testing beyond like an ultrasound, like a stress test or anything like that?
Not if you're not having any symptoms. Again, I would defer to the physician that you see, but usually if you're not having any symptoms, I would start with that and kind of go from there. But I do think it's a good idea to get checked out by a cardiologist and kind of go through all your symptoms and see really what you need.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Patrick. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Doctor, you mentioned ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
What other sort of imaging do you do?
So there's echocardiogram. I also do some vascular studies, meaning ultrasounds of the lower legs, the arteries in the lower legs, as well as nuclear studies, which, as this other caller was alluding to, are stress tests. So there's different type of stress tests.
What sort of things are you looking for when you do ultrasounds and imaging of the arteries in the lower leg?
So what we're looking for is we're looking for narrowing that could be causing symptoms for the patient, so leg pains and leg cramps that could be suggestive of blockages. We also look for your run-of-the-mill blood clots as well.
Okay, so something that may be in the leg is an indicator that there may be a problem higher up.
Yeah, you know, all the arteries are connected to the heart. So if you have a blockage in your lower leg artery, it could be an indicator that you could have some blockages in your heart.
Hmm. Our number here, 800-348-2551. And back to the phones we go. Patricia in Albany. Patricia.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting show. I have a question. I have been noticing that older women who are going to the doctor regularly, all of a sudden they're told that they have 90% blockage, 80% blockage. And if these women didn't have a certain symptom, like, for example, a sore back, that was my mother, and then another woman, she fainted. But these women are going to their primary care often enough. Why can't any medical imaging be done to notice this blockage? Because of that 90%.
Okay. We lost you there, Patricia, but I think we got your gist.
Yeah. So great question, Patricia. So I think that, you know, the problem is that females, as most people have probably heard, can present in various formats in terms of symptoms that they have. It's not necessarily your run-of-the-mill chest pressure that a man would get.
Can I stop for a minute? Why is that happening?
You know, I don't think that we know completely why. We know with diabetics when that happens, it's because of a lack of nerve. Sometimes they don't have similar nerve contribution.
Well, I mean, physiologically, they're male and female fairly close, right, in the cardiac department?
It is very true. And it's not really known why females present in different ways. They may have different pain receptors, but forever. Whatever reason, we do know that they do.
Okay.
And so what I would suggest, you know, I think it's a topic that comes up a lot. And as a female, you know, I'm very passionate about it. There is new testing, new coronary calcium CT testing, which primary cares routinely do offer. They can schedule out or you could get through a cardiologist. And it really looks at the calcium buildup in the coronary arteries. And that can lead us to say if someone is at risk for having a heart attack, which is bottom line what we're all trying to prevent. So I think, you know, from our last caller, it would be beneficial for her to talk with her primary care and say, you know, am I at risk? Should I get this new coronary calcium CT to look at the calcium buildup in my arteries?
The number here is 800-348-2551. We talk cardiology today with Dr. Leslie Parikh. And let's see who's been waiting. Laurel in Schenectady. Laurel, you're on.
Hi, Laurel.
Hi. I'm really wanting to just give a big thank you. My dad was one of the first people who had the Watchman, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in rough shape before that, and he just got back from 3 weeks of a trip to New Zealand and sang at my son's wedding in California and is almost 90. So
wow.
Procedure was fantastic and a great success and really changed his life and gave him his life back.
Thank you so much, Laurel. You know, that's really good to hear. And that's what we're, I'm sure I've met your dad. and that's really what our goal is, to help people be able to get off of blood thinners with this procedure and really get back to doing what they enjoy.
Well, why are blood thinners a bad thing?
So, you know, they're not. In the majority of people, blood thinners are a good thing. But if you have a predisposition to bleeding, so you have bleeds in your intestinal tract.
So we're talking internal bleeding, not a cut that.
Exactly. Okay. We're talking about internal bleeding, which is, you know, few and far between, but it does happen. It really puts you at risk to be on these blood thinners because they can lead to a need for more transfusions and problems requiring hospital stays.
Now, our last caller said it really improved the quality of her dad's life,
mm-hmm.
and he's an older fellow. As you described the Watchman, and I'm sure there's much more nuance than I was capable of understanding, being a radio man, but it seemed like it was mainly a filter to prevent strokes,
mm-hmm.
not improve quality of life.
Yeah. I think it depends on how bad or how much the anticoagulation or blood, it's a fancy name for blood thinners, are affecting your quality of life. So if you're really needing, you know, if you have a low blood level related to blood thinners, you can feel fatigued, you can feel more tired.
I see.
And that can really affect your quality of life. So happy to hear that it helps.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Parikh is our guest on a Medical Monday. And Howard in Northampton. Howard, you're on.
Hi, Howard.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm 69 years old. I just recently had my annual physical, and my doctor found a heart murmur. He graded it at 1/2 out of 5. He wasn't concerned, and I'm wondering if I should be.
Yeah, you know, good question. You know, heart murmurs can be for a variety of reasons. As people get older, they are more likely to have a heart murmur because if you have thickening of any of your aortic valves or any valve that happens with age, it can cause turbulence as blood pushes against it. And that's what we hear that constitutes a murmur.
So a heart murmur is blood turbulence?
Exactly.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. And so, you know, the easiest way to get it checked out if your physician feels necessary is doing an echocardiogram, so an ultrasound of the heart that really looks at the valves and takes some pictures. Now, if the murmur is very soft, such as the one that you described, it's usually of no clinical significance and an echocardiogram is not needed. But I would have you follow up with your doctor and just see what they say.
Now, Howard's doctor graded it on a 1-5 scale as a 1/2. What is this 1-5 scale?
So usually, you know, murmurs are often graded on a 1-6 scale, and it's graded upon the severity and also the way, the frequency, the way it sounds. And if you're in the 1-2 range, it's usually more of what we call a flow murmur. So just the murmur of the blood flow against the valve. As it gets louder, it can be more valve pathology or abnormalities.
Is it? Thank you, Howard, for the call. Is that predictive, though? Say you have a 1 or 1/2 or 2 on the scale. Is this predictive? And your doctor says, well, you better be in here next year and we have to check this again and again every year?
Yeah, no. A lot of times people's valve murmurs or their thickening of their valve stays the same. It may progress as they get very older until their 90s. But again, the easiest way to confirm that is just to do an echocardiogram. You know, it's a non-invasive procedure. There's no risks associated with it. And it really does give us more detail in terms of why you're having that murmur.
Our guest today is Dr. Leslie Parikh. It's Medical Monday. Cardiology, the topic. The number is 800-348-2551. Kathy in Delmar. Kathy, you're on.
Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I just want to say, I don't know if you've ever considered teaching, but you just have a way with explaining things. That's wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
But my father is 87, soon to be 88. He's probably listening as we speak. He was recently diagnosed with AFib. And I don't know. I mean, I know a previous caller spoke about her father, who's in his 90s. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if this Watchman procedure would be warranted for someone of that age.
Yeah, you know, we do procedures at Ellis, definitely with people of that age. Does he have any bleeding problems?
He has had problems over the years with nosebleeds, but mm-hmm. nothing necessarily chronic.
Yeah. What I would say is it's definitely worth for him to see a cardiologist and kind of figure out if the Watchman would be an appropriate procedure for him. Certainly his age does not preclude him, and we do this procedure with people in their 80s all the time because, you know, as people get older, they get more comorbidities or more problems. And I think it sounds like he potentially could be a good candidate.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah.
What makes a bad candidate?
You know, there has to be a reason for it. So nothing in particular except a very limited life expectancy, because then it wouldn't be worth it to go through the procedure.
So if I went in and they said, hey, listen, it's not worth
there's
it.
There's no hope.
Yeah, you just better make your final arrangements. I understand. Let's go to Donna, who's in the car. Donna, where are you calling from?
Yeah, hi. I got a physical about a year ago, and when I got my physical, the doctor told me my heart was racing, mm-hmm. but I couldn't feel it race.
Mm-hmm.
How would I find out, like, know from day to day if it's racing or not?
So, you know, the best thing to do for that usually, and, you know, obviously this would be at your physician's discretion, but is to check a monitor of your heart rate and really see, you know, what's going on and is your heart rate really going fast? And more importantly, what rhythm is it? Is it the regular rhythm or do you have something called an arrhythmia or an irregular heart rhythm? And so the best way to do that is to wear a monitor where we can really see over time what's happening with your heart rate.
Yeah, she had me wear, I went to a doctor and she had me wear a harness for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't.
And she didn't see. It didn't seem like it was, you know, abnormal in any way.
Yeah, so then you might just have what's called a sinus tachycardia or a fast heart rate related to regular rhythm. So, you know, if the person that interpreted that monitor thought it looked okay, I think you have nothing to worry about. You know, alternatively, there are longer-term monitorings. We have a 30-day monitor that you could wear, which is obviously, you know, a little painful to have to wear something for 30 days, but it gives more data.
And where does the telemetry go?
It goes on you. So you have sticker pads. There's different variations, but you have sticker pads that you wear on you, and you can put the little pocket pouch in your pocket.
In other words, is it stored and then you bring it into the doctor?
Yeah.
Or do you automatically get it over Bluetooth, let's say?
So it's stored and you drop it off at the end. But the good part about these monitors is if you have a problem, at least the ones we use at Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis, is that it automatically gets transmitted over. So we see those. So say you have something bad happen in the middle of the night with your heart rate and you don't even know. That will be automatically sent to our physician that's on call who will get a call who will then be calling you.
Interesting. And waking you up and saying, hey, you're having an issue.
Yeah.
Hey, Donna, thanks for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday, Cardiology Today with Dr. Leslie Parikh. And now we go to Matt in Rexford. Matt.
Hi. I am 62.
Mm-hmm.
I am under treatment with rosuvastatin, 40 milligrams a day.
Okay.
I went on a vegan plus fish diet, lost 20 pounds.
Uh-huh.
And I'm at my ideal body weight or a little below. And I vigorously exercise at least 4 times a week.
Good for you.
My question is, since I changed my lifestyle and lost weight and probably greatly decreased the amount of fat in my diet,
mm-hmm.
Will I be able to reduce the dosage or get off the medication?
Yeah, so that's a good question. You know, a couple parts to that question. So the first thing would be repeating the blood work to see what's happened to your cholesterol on this new lifestyle modification. And if it has gone down substantially to the goal, your individual goal, which is determined by your comorbidities, and you may be able to at least reduce it, the dose. You know, that does depend on your risk factors. So one, have you ever had any heart disease or heart blockages? Two, do you have diabetes? And three, do you have any calcium buildup in your coronary arteries? So if that's determined,
I have the third, but I don't have either of the first two you mentioned.
So you have coronary calcium that was seen on a CT scan?
Yes, a yeah. CAC test and a follow-up.
Yeah, so I think then, depending upon that, you may be able to reduce the dose depending upon what your cholesterol level looks like and what your physician thinks. I probably will not be able to come off of it completely, but it sounds like you're doing a great job. And if your LDL is lower, you may be able to reduce that Crestor dose.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Matt. Number here, 800-348-2551. Fran in Saratoga. Hello, Fran.
Hi, Fran.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have a leaky bicuspid valve, and I understand that that often correlates to an enlarged aorta. Mm-hmm. I know what to do if the valve needs to be replaced, mm-hmm. but what is the treatment for an enlarged aorta?
So I'm assuming because you do have a bicuspid valve with regurgitation or leakiness, you are under the care of a cardiologist. But what happens is we usually do imaging with CAT scans of the aorta to see how enlarged it is. Once it reaches a certain level, you have to have it repaired, usually through open surgery, meaning they go in and they put a graft in to make the aorta smaller. Now, it does depend on the size and, you know, what your valve looks like as well.
What makes an aorta mm-hmm. and get larger?
So it can be for a variety of things. Bicuspid in general, the thought is that there's some changes in the lining of the blood vessel that's associated with this bicuspid valve that causes it to enlarge.
Okay. Fran, you want to follow up?
Great. No, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Medical Monday today, Dr. Leslie Parikh of the Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine, not Ellison Medicine. That would be interesting. Let's go now before we take a break, and we'll go to Bill in Niskayuna. Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Hello. Hello. Yes, you were speaking about heart murmurs earlier, and that's the question that I had. I was born in 1948 with a heart murmur and was not allowed to play baseball in the seventh grade because the doctor noticed it and checking me out. I've never been in a hospital in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if the medical field has changed their opinions about heart murmurs in general.
Yeah, you know, you mean as opposed to when you were in middle school?
That's right.
Yeah, I think we know more because we have, in the sense that we have more technology, so we can look at why you have a heart murmur and determine if it's benign, meaning not dangerous, or if it is related to something more dangerous. Certainly, if you've had that since you were a young child, yours is a benign variant, nothing to worry about.
I heard you mentioning levels of heart murmur 1 to 6 or whatever, mm-hmm. and I don't remember being checked out by doctors and ever hearing a level that I might not have had. So I think maybe things have changed a bit. And also I have an uncle who is 94, worked hard all his life, and was not allowed into the military. He was given a 4F during World War II. When they would take anybody with two arms and two legs, but they wouldn't take him because he had a heart murmur.
Yeah, huh. I think you're correct. I do think that times have changed in terms of we know more, and we know that a lot of times there are benign heart murmurs. And certainly as you're growing up, you're a young teen or a growing boy, you can have something called a flow murmur, which basically is just fast blood flow as you're growing.
Okay. Hey, we have to take a break here, Bill. Thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Parikh, our guest. It's Medical Monday. We'll be back with the home stretch. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok. Dr. Leslie Parikh is our guest. Cardiology, the topic today. Two quick emails, doctor, and then we'll do the home stretch on the phones. This one came in from Brian. And Brian writes, last year my uncle had an aortic dissection from an aneurysm and lived. My dad had an exam soon after, and they found an aneurysm in the same place right above the aortic valve. With a strong family history of heart disease, clearly I have great genetics, Brian writes. He had surgery to remove it and got a cow valve replacement. The surgeon said the valve lasts 15 to 20 years due to a problem during surgery. They also had to do a double bypass. Compared to the value, how long do those bypasses last?
So, you know, it depends on where the bypass is. The standard bypass, it depends if they use a radial artery or if they use a vein. But a radial artery can last essentially forever in terms of on the bypass graft itself. A vein usually lasts about 10 to 15 years. But usually in the more central locations for the bypass, the CT surgeons do decide to use the radial arteries.
Okay. This one is from... not sure who this is from, but it's an email. It came in a few moments ago, and this one says, this morning I got up for work and immediately started sweating, and my heart began what felt like weak beating but fast, like a flutter. I had to stop on the way in to rest while it settled down. This also happens when I'm walking up small inclines, and I have to stop while it settles. I also notice a rushing sound in my ears sometimes as it calms down. What could be causing this, and how dangerous is it?
You know, so there's a lot of things that could cause those symptoms, and those are very common symptoms that I see in the cardiology office. I would say run-of-the-mill low blood pressure or just being dehydrated could definitely cause those symptoms. But heart rhythm problems could also cause those symptoms again. So I think the most important thing to figure it out is wearing a monitor and being checked out by either a physician or a cardiologist to see, is this just simple, your blood sugar is low because you haven't eaten or you're dehydrated, or do you have an underlying rhythm or artery problem? And the way to do that would be through testing.
Worthy of testing, for sure.
I that's definitely worthy to see a cardiologist and start with your primary care physician, who can also order a lot of tests to further evaluate it.
Dr. Leslie Parikh is our guest, and back to the phones we go. Carol in Lake Luzerne. Carol, how are you?
Hi, Carol.
I'm good. How are you?
Well, we're all right.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello. Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I'm 75. The only medication I take is vitamin D because I have a very low vitamin D level, and the doctor hasn't been able to fix it. And every once in a while, I'll be fine. My blood pressure is always about 130 over 80, but then all of a sudden I'll get very dizzy, and I'll take my blood pressure to be like 80 over 48, and my heart rate will be 170 or more. And that lasts for a couple minutes, and then if I take my blood pressure again, say 10 minutes later, my blood pressure is about 160 over 100, and it stays that way for a few hours, and then it goes back to normal. And I've just been diagnosed with hyperparathyroid, and my calcium level is almost 10.
Wow. It's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. So what I would say with that is, you have a lot going on. I think both should probably be addressed. Certainly calcium homeostasis problems, or problems with your body regulating calcium, can lead to the symptoms that you just described. That being said, I think probably both should get worked up. If I had to choose which first, I would say, go get evaluated in terms of, do they think you need surgery for the hyperparathyroidism, or what do they want to do? But again,
well, I'm set up for nuclear stress test and the other heart test, and I'm having a hard time getting an appointment with an endocrinologist. They're evidently very, very busy.
Yeah. I think that I agree with setting up for the stress test and the other testing that you said. So, I would start with that. Certainly what we want to make sure is that the symptoms that you're having, as with the last caller, are not related to a rhythm problem. So further workup is definitely warranted for you from a heart perspective.
All right. Good luck, Carol. Thank you for the call. Not all stress tests are nuclear stress tests, right?
Yes. Nope.
What's the advantage of the nuclear stress test?
So, you know, each stress test has different advantages and limitations. A nuclear stress test advantage is, one, if you can't walk, it's a test for people that can't walk because we can give kind of fake stress to the heart. And also it allows the physician who's interpreting the study to actually look at images. So it creates almost like a CAT scan-like image. Mm. So it gives us a little bit more detail.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Leslie Parikh is our guest. Jeff in Northampton. Jeff, Jeff, hello.
Oh, hi. I am here.
Hi.
So I have a specific question. Yeah, but thank you. About 2 years ago, I suffered a ruptured chordae tendineae of one of my posterior mitral valve leaflet.
Okay.
And around that time, I was in AFib. And at the time of the surgery to replace the cord, the surgeon tied off my left atrial appendage, which I thought was great. But ever since then, I've sort of had lower exercise tolerance. And I was wondering, do you know how much the left atrial appendage in a 65-year-old man contributes to cardiac output?
Yeah, you know, I think it's usually pretty much nothing, or it is nothing. So the left atrial appendage is in the top part of the heart. It's a very small chamber. The bottom part of the heart, or the ventricle, is more related to the cardiac output, or how much blood your body's able to push through the rest of your body. And so I would suspect that your symptoms probably related to the surgery in general, and certainly having a ruptured papillary muscle and chordae tendineae can contribute to increased fatigue as well as decreased output. So that may be kind of your culprit area.
Even after it's been fixed?
Even if after it's been fixed, it obviously was an insult to have that happen to you, a cardiac insult, meaning it takes a long time to recover from it. I think, you know, you may benefit from cardiac rehab or really focused exercise programs to increase the strength as well as the stamina of the heart.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
So insult is a medical term?
It is. It is.
A lot of doctors in the newsroom. That's amazing. Tom and Gardner. Tom, you're on.
Good program once again. I just wanted to put in a plug for cardiac rehab.
All right.
I've been in rehab for years, and we do the monitor group, you know, for 12 weeks, and after that we go into maintenance. And it's too bad most more hospitals didn't have a cardiac rehab program where they check your pulse rate and blood pressure and, you know, monitor your medication and, you know, stress exercising every day.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, I just talked about that with the other caller. Cardiac rehab plays a big role for anyone that's had any type of, you know, cardiac injury, be it heart attack or heart failure. It's like supervised exercise with trained staff members and physical therapists who are know what they're supposed to be looking for and can kind of get the most out of it. And all of my patients that have undergone it really, truly love it. They lose weight and they're feeling better.
And it's also a good social outlet. We have a lot of fun.
It is. Also. It is. And it's a safe way to exercise. You know, people are scared to exercise after they have heart attacks. And, you know, this is a way that you can do it without being scared. And, you know, Ellis, I think, has a great rehab program that's offered to a lot of cardiac patients. So,
well, Tom, thanks for the call very much. We appreciate it. Now to Harriet in Woodstock. Hello, Harriet.
Hi there. Hi.
Hi, Harriet.
Hi. I have two question. The first one, kind of quickly, I mean, dehydration is a problem, and I think a lot of times people don't know how to hydrate and what the actual symptoms are if you're getting to that point where you're dehydrated. That's
mm-hmm.
question one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is, can you say anything about the influence of the vagus nerve on cardiac rhythm?
Yes. So the first one in terms of dehydration, I agree that plays a big role more so than people do realize. It can present in a lot of symptoms. Dizziness is a main one, just feeling fatigued, feeling nauseous. You know, depending upon, this should always be cleared by an individual physician, but usually we want people to drink at least 6 glasses of water a day. You know, if you do have some cardiac issues, we may not say 8, but certainly dehydration is a very common problem. Now, in terms of
and
the
glass is what, 6 ounces, 8 ounces?
Usually 8 ounces, that's what we consider a glass, about 8 ounces.
Okay.
And then in terms of the vagal nerve, so it can play a role in a lot of things. You know, the what's called a vagal episode is the common faint. So this happens when people see blood or they're very nervous and they pass out. That's kind of like a vagal episode. What it actually does is it slows down your heart rate, and it also causes your arteries to dilate, which can make your blood pressure drop, and essentially why you pass out, because you're... You know, your body says, hey, brain, I don't have enough oxygen and blood. I'm going to shut down to help preserve. So it's actually a mechanism that helps keep your body intact. Oh. It's very common.
It is. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, thanks, Sarah. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Before the next call, you mentioned to Harriet that in some cases you may not recommend, a cardiologist might not recommend the patient drink 8 glasses, but mm-hmm. 6. Why would lessening the amount of water affect the recovery?
Because, you know, the bottom line is if you have something called heart failure, which is basically a fancy, scary term for just a buildup of fluid in either your lungs or your legs in your body. And so if you drink too much water, that can you retain more. So people that are predisposed to that, we actually can restrict how much fluid they take.
Ah, okay. Back to the phones we go. And Jeff in Unionvale. Jeff, you're on.
Hi, Jeff.
Thanks, and great program. Thanks, guys. I guess I'm going to title this with saying I got rhythm, and here's what it is.
Oh, no.
I'm 64 years old. I have low, not bad, but low blood pressure, low cholesterol, most of it's HDL, never had any heart issues whatsoever, healthy as a horse, get lots of exercise. But ever since I was 16, 17 years old, and they started doing these EKGs, my heart skips a half a beat every 3 or 4 beats, mm-hmm. and it goes lub dub, lub dub, lub dub, lub. And by the way, it only beats about, at rest, 55 beats a minute. I do a lot of exercise, like I said. So my question, and I'm a certified pilot, so it doesn't impede my activities in any way. Is this common, and do you perhaps have some insight about it?
Yeah, it's very common. So what you're describing is premature ventricular contractions or premature atrial contractions by the sounds of it. And it's just an extra heartbeat that gets thrown into the mix. I see patients frequently for this. It's usually benign, meaning not of any dangerous means, assuming that it is not, you know, every other beat for prolonged periods of time. But it can be caused by a lot of things. Some people are just more predisposed to it. Certainly stress, caffeine, fever, any type of sickness, or, you know, being female in general actually can also predispose you to having more of these extra beats, and they're usually of no significant fine. They're not serious.
Well, that's not one of my factors, being female.
Yeah, I know.
I remember when I went for my pilot physical, and I just was afraid that they were going to say something bad, and I laid off the caffeine for like 4 or 5 days, and that's probably when my ex decided to become my ex.
Nice.
And, you know, nothing changes it, and it's just, it never bothered me. The doctors don't get upset about it, but thank you for the explanation.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not dangerous at all.
Thanks, Jeff. We appreciate the call. And Mary in Athens. Mary, you're next.
Yes, hi. I have AFib and associated with it pleural effusion, and I've had my lungs drained twice, and now the medication I take seems to have the pleural effusion under control. But I'm just wondering, I know I'm not supposed to drink too much water, and I'm just wondering how I tell if the lungs have filled up again. Is it by weight gain? Is it by being tired? Do I need to worry about it? Do I really care?
Well, I hope you care, but, you know, I think
I do, but I mean, I'm paranoid all the time.
Yeah, it definitely can get very stressful. You know, I think that usually symptoms are, weight gain is a good one. So is your weight increasing more than, you know, 3 pounds in a day? And we usually use that as a general guideline.
No, I probably am okay.
Yeah.
I've had at least 2 chest x-rays. Do I have as many as they want me to have? Is that healthy?
Yeah, I think
that's
that is
the only way.
Yeah, I think usually that's the main way they can tell if the fluid's building up or if your oxygen level is dropping. So I would definitely go by what your doctors recommend in terms of how many x-rays they need, because they would only be giving you them if they thought it was medically necessary, if you may need another pleural effusion drainage or a change in your medications.
Okay. All right, thank you. And does AFib ever go away on its own?
You can have paroxysms of it, so meaning you have it and then you won't have it for a couple of years. But the majority of people, if they do have it, will have it again.
Okay. Can I get 20 more years? I'm 72. I need
yes.
at least 20 to 30 more years.
I've never met you, but I say yes.
That was very definitive.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Mary. We appreciate the call. And now we quickly go over to Kathleen in Utica. Kathleen.
Hi, thanks for my call. My question is, what is the cardiologist's view of fat?
Yeah.
Particularly, dietary fat, saturated fat, such as you would find in typical beef products. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Kathleen.
You know, I think that there would be a wide range depending upon what physician you speak with, but I think in general, good fats are good. Beef fats are not that good for you. I mean, certainly in moderation, it does give you some iron, but in terms of animal products, you're better off getting your fats and your omega-3s from salmon and non-animal, so avocados, other lean fishes, olive oils, in my opinion. I think it decreases your cholesterol level, and it's more sustainable over the long run. Certainly, this is a hot topic. People have a lot of weight loss success with the keto diet and more high-fat diets, which can be helpful, but they should always be under a physician's discretion as well.
All right. Our number is 800-348-2551. We only have a minute or two left here. Let's go to David in Albany. David.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good.
Let's see. I have a question you may not have heard of before. I'm 60 years old. I read Dr. Kenneth Cooper's book, Aerobics, back when I was a teenager. A friend of mine turned me on to that. And ever since then, I've done cardio work, running at first, but then the problems I have with my knees inclined me towards biking and, I guess, in recent years, what people call spinning.
Hello? Yes, we only have about 30 seconds here.
I also do... I just turned 60 a week ago, and I do yoga breathing, and sometimes I won't be able to sleep, and I'll do 2 or 3 hours of yoga breathing in the middle of the night. And I've noticed that when I do that, sometimes I get a strange heartbeat after about 2 hours. I'll be lying in bed, and I'll hear my heart, and it'll take two beats and then a rest. It'll go something like boom, 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 boom. On one occasion, they would do three and then a rest, but I've heard that consistently, and I've never heard anybody discuss anything.
All right,
we're
almost out of time here, so quickly, doctor.
Yeah, so very quickly, I think that your heart rate can change depending upon the style of your breathing and how fast and deep you're breathing. So, in the limited amount of time left, I would say the one way to really know is to look through a monitor and wear a 24-hour monitor and do that deep breathing when you're wearing the monitor and see what it really shows.
Well, this was fun. Now, Dr. Parikh, did you have a good time?
Yeah,
really?
I had fun. Thanks for having me.
You were very relaxed for a first-timer. Well done. Support for WAMC comes from MVP Healthcare, offering Medicare advice for people turning age 65 or retiring. More information at MVPMedicare.com. Well, that's it for the show today. Thank you for being with us. Great calls, great emails. Thanks to Dr. Leslie Parikh of the Cardiology Associates of Schenectady and Ellis Medicine for joining us today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who operated perfectly at the controls. Joe Makowitz answered the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Vox Pop, we're going to laugh it up with the hilarious gang from the Copyright Forum. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.